next on RadioSaintPete.com, another edition of Peter's Proffer Podcast, a podcast featuring experienced lawyers Peter Tragos and Peter Sartes. The experienced lawyers at Tragos, Sartes, and Tragos in Clearwater discuss common legal questions, provide some insight into the legal process, and cover current events as they relate to the legal field.
Welcome back into the courtroom of current events here on Peter's Proffer. Today, we're going to dig into the insanity defense. Most people hear about it on the news in some high-profile cases or TV shows or movies. Well, today, we're going to dig in and explain what it is, how you prove it, and whether or not it's usually successful. And to help do that, at the end of the show today, we're interviewing a forensic psychologist who specializes in this type of defense. So make sure you listen in till the end. As always, if you want to leave us any comments or questions, find us on social media at Tragos Law. But for now, let's get to the music. All right, it's time to get insane in the membrane here on Peter's Proffer. We're going to talk about the insanity defense. And to start out, let's talk about what the Florida statute defines this affirmative defense. Okay, all persons are presumed to be sane. It is an affirmative defense to a criminal prosecution that, at the time of the commission of the acts constituting the offense, the defendant was insane. Insanity is established when A, the defendant had a mental infirmity, disease, or defect, and B, because of this condition, the defendant, one, did not know what he or she was doing or its consequences, or two, although the defendant knew what he or she was doing and its consequences, the defendant did not know what he or she was doing was wrong. Okay, so I've got Peter Sartes and my dad, George Tragos, here to discuss this. What does that mean to a layperson, that definition that we just read of the insanity defense?
Well, most lay people think that if you're insane, that's all it takes. And it goes way beyond just being insane. It has to do with, do you know what you're doing? Do you know what you're doing has consequences? Do you understand that you're actually killing somebody when you're doing it? Because we've got to realize in this country, we have a situation where mens rea, you have to know what you're doing to commit a crime. We don't send people to prison if they don't know they're committing crimes.
So talk about then the difference between somebody just being insane and then somebody being eligible for the insanity defense.
All right. Well, first of all, in order to be able to bring the insanity defense, you have to be competent at the time that you're standing trial. The insanity defense is specific. You have to be insane at the time of the commission of the crime, but still competent enough to be tried.
Okay. So let's say somebody wants to plead insanity and they're insane and they're still incompetent, because there's a difference between insane and incompetent. What happens to an incompetent defendant that wants to plead insanity in a criminal prosecution?
Well, if you're incompetent, meaning you cannot help with your defense or you don't understand the proceedings that are going on around you, you can't plead anything.
So what happens to that defendant?
That defendant winds up going to the state mental hospital, and they sit there, or actually they're treated there, until such time as they're brought back to competence.
Okay, so in our hypothetical, let's go forward now on somebody has committed the crime, and they want to plead insanity, and they've been rendered competent to stand trial. So now we're going with a person that is competent now, but was insane at the time that the act was committed. Do you have to actually admit that you committed that crime before you plead insanity?
You don't have to admit it, but you can't deny that you actually committed those acts, because that's part of your defense, is that you committed the acts, but you didn't know what you're doing at the time you committed the acts.
So there's all sorts of ways to go about being a criminal defense lawyer. Sometimes you're trying to prove that your client, and you never have a burden of proof, but sometimes you're trying to show your client didn't do whatever this crime was. Sometimes you're poking holes in the prosecution. So what you're saying is, in an insanity defense, you still make the prosecutor or the state or the government prove that your client committed the crime, right?
Right. They never lose that burden. They
right.
have to prove the case. But then the burden does shift, because the way the law reads, then we have to prove that there is insanity.
Okay, talk a little bit about the fact that it's an affirmative defense, because we've even had some cases where they have video evidence of our client committing the crime. Does that mean you can't have an insanity defense, or can you still use an insanity defense in that type of case where they have a video of your client committing the crime?
You can still use the insanity defense. Because,
why is that?
Well, because the defense is the mens rea. Even though you did the acts that constitute the crime, did you have the mental capability to understand what you were doing and that it was a willful and knowing commission of the crime?
So that's what an affirmative defense is. An affirmative defense is, even though you committed the crime, you are still not guilty of the offense. There's a nuance there. So just because you committed the act doesn't mean that you're guilty. It also doesn't mean that you're innocent, even if you win on an insanity defense. It means you are not guilty of that crime. So explain a little bit about how you go about proving this insanity defense. So you're getting ready for this trial, but you have to put on proof and talk about a little bit about how that burden shifts to us as the criminal defense lawyer after the state has, you know, assumingly proven that our client committed the act.
All right. Presuming the state's proved the elements of the offense, then the burden shifts to the defendant to prove that at the time of the commission of the offense, the defendant was suffering from some sort of mental infirmity, and that he or she did not recognize what they were doing was wrong, or the consequences of what they were doing. And to put that simply, is when we, as a defense, put on expert witnesses and sometimes lay witnesses, meaning people that just witness stuff, to testify to what they witnessed, what they saw, that somebody looked crazy, they were acting foolish, they were talking about things that didn't make sense. The doctors then get involved. They review the documentation.
And what? Yeah, who are the experts that you call in these types of cases?
Two types, psychiatrists and psychologists. Normally, they're going to be what's called forensic experts as opposed to treating doctors, meaning that they actually look at things from a legal standpoint as opposed to treating.
Forensic experts are people that work specifically on legal cases.
Correct. And what you'll do is you'll have them, and normally they will render their opinion prior to testifying.
What do they do? When you're billing this defense, say you're going to hire a forensic psychologist or psychiatrist, what does that expert do to help you in your case?
They're going to review the evidence that law enforcement gathered. They're going to evaluate your defendant, meaning they're going to go talk to the defendant and look through their medical history there to determine, A, do they have a mental illness? Is there a mental defect? And if the answer is yes, then the next step is, did this mental defect affect their ability to understand the right or wrong of the actions that they were committing at the time?
So when they interview the client and when they look through the medical records, they're trying to figure out, at the time that the crime was committed, what mind frame or mental state was the defendant in?
All right, it's their responsibility to go back in time. They might talk to your client weeks or months after the commission of the act. So they have to go back in time, recreate that day, and decide what was your client's mental state that day. That's why it's so important when you talk about gathering evidence to also talk to the people that were there that day, the police officers. What the police officers heard? Did they interview your client? Did he say that he shot a teddy bear as opposed to his father? Was he confused? Was he disheveled? What was the house? What was the condition of the house or condition of the location? People that know your client who talked to him around that time. All of that goes into what the forensic psychologist, psychiatrist says. So it's important to get the background. It's important to get the history of what happened that day from the witnesses that were actually there at the scene of the crime.
Okay, so when we're talking about proving this and building this case, a lot of this happens before the trial. So when the client is getting interviewed, when they're going through his medical records, all sorts of things like that, that the defense witnesses are doing, the prosecution at the same time is A, putting together their evidence to prove that the crime was committed, but they're also doing discovery and putting on evidence and trying to build evidence that our client was sane at the time the act was committed, correct?
Correct. You have to give the state notice that you are going for the insanity defense.
And why is that?
Well, so that they have the opportunity to bring their own experts in. Their experts have a right to examine your client and make a determination whether or not he was sane according to the statute at the time he committed the acts.
What about the Fifth Amendment? Which is the right to remain silent. Are you waiving that if you do an insanity defense?
Yes, you're waiving that because they have a right to examine your client just like your doctor has a right to examine your client. And that's the reason why you don't really contest that the crime happened, because when the doctor goes up on the stand and testifies, they're going to say what your client said about the criminal act that's being charged.
So here's a question. So let's say the defendant thinks that ghosts are following him and ghosts are going to get him, and he shoots at a ghost and he actually ends up killing somebody else that wasn't a ghost. But they still think that's what happened when they get interviewed by the psychiatrist or psychologist. Does that mean they're still insane now, or does it mean they're incompetent to stand trial? How do you deal with something that they still believe happened when it obviously didn't happen?
Well, and that's kind of a double-edged question, because it could be a psychosis, meaning that this person has a mental defect that never goes away, and whatever that trigger is still in their heads. But as long as they can appreciate that they're being tried for a crime, and they understand that they're in a court proceeding, and that they're able to help the lawyers with the defense, they're competent and they can go forward. There are circumstances, though, when that person is just not in at that point. They're just so far gone that they can't help you, and that's when you're not going to trial at that point.
Are there ever situations where the defense experts think that a client was insane at the time of the crime, is competent now, and should be not guilty by reason of insanity, and the prosecution's expert actually agrees with that? Are there ever a time where the experts all agree that the person was insane at the time of the act?
Yes, it does happen.
And what happens in that case?
At that point, normally the state attorney's office will concede that an individual's not guilty by reason of insanity. And as opposed to going through the entire trial process, you basically just go to court and have the judge ratify that determination. And then, I mean, you're not off the hook yet.
Okay, but well, let's flip it around. Let's talk about what happens when you send your client to your expert psychologist, your forensic psychologist that does the interview, goes through the medical records, and your psychologist tells you, I don't think they were insane at the time of the crime. I think they knew exactly what they did. Either they were lying, or I don't think it rises to the level of a mental infirmity. Then what do you do with the insanity defense?
Well, then you scrap the insanity defense, and you don't tell the state about it, and you let it go.
Okay, so you can have your psychologist or psychiatrist interview the defendant and give an opinion before you notice the state that you're doing an insanity defense.
Absolutely, and you should do that.
Okay, because to be fair to criminal defense lawyers, if he wasn't insane at the time of the crime, then you don't have an insanity defense, right?
Right, you don't present a defense, and the state doesn't have to present doctors, and that particular defense goes by the wayside, and you start looking for another defense.
Okay, so let's say we have established an insanity defense. The defense doctors say the client was insane at the time of the crime, and the state doctors say that he was not. What does a trial look like at that point?
Well, at that point, the state puts on their case. They prove the crime was committed, and then they rest. The defense then has the responsibility to raise the insanity defense. They then put on their doctors or
independent
witnesses.
So before it gets to the defense's case, Has the state put on any doctors prior to the defense going?
Normally not. Sometimes it is reversed, and sometimes they do, because you may open the door in your opening statement during a trial. But generally speaking, the defense goes first with their insanity defense.
So is that an opportunity sometimes for you to wait to do your opening until after the state closes their case in chief?
Yes, that's a decision that you have to make, right?
So in a lawyer's mind, an insanity defense is kind of cool because you've got to do so many different things, and it's a different strategy throughout the trial, because the first step of the trial, you make the state prove that the crime was committed by the defendant. Then you start your case in chief as the defense, and as opposed to some other cases where most of your case in chief is just cross-examining the officers and cross-examining the state's witnesses, poking holes, now you're actually putting on a case in chief when the defense goes, right? So what does that look like? You do your opening and you explain that your client didn't understand that what he was doing was actually a crime, or didn't understand the consequences. And now what do you do in your case in chief?
Well, you go through the elements with the jury so they understand what you're trying to do. You tell the jury who your witnesses are going to be and what those witnesses are going to say. You talk about your doctors. You talk about your experts. You also talk about the lay witnesses that knew your client and saw how bizarre he was acting.
And saw that he snapped a week before this crime was committed, and he used to be totally normal. Then all of a sudden, he didn't know what was going on.
Right. Or, you know, he's eating grass all day.
Right.
And,
and lay witnesses or fact witnesses can testify to that.
Right.
Okay. So you put on your doctors. You put on your experts. Do you have to call your client now?
You do not have to call your client. And frankly, in most cases, you probably don't call your client.
Why is that?
Well, because what your client has to say, your doctor should be already saying it. Whether he is saying, look, I thought it was a teddy bear I was shooting. Well, the doctor should say, he told me he thought it was a teddy bear. And this way you don't subject your client to cross-examination.
Okay, so now you've put on your case in chief, and what happens? Because the state didn't call any doctors during their case.
Well, then you rest, and then the state has their opportunity to rebut whatever it is you said about the insanity defense.
So the case gets to do what's called a rebuttal, which means they now get to bring their own witnesses, right? Even though they closed their case in chief because we brought out this insanity defense, now they have the opportunity to bring their doctors to disagree, basically, with the defense's doctors?
Yes, and, you know, point of fact, the jury, the last ones they hear are the state's experts.
So once the state puts on their experts, now it's time for closing arguments. And because the state has the burden, they get to argue at the beginning and at the end, right?
Right. We're sandwiched in the middle.
Right. So the defense attorney. So basically what happens after the defense put on their case in chief, the state gets another chance to call more witnesses. Once they're done, the state gets to do a closing argument. The defense does a closing argument, and the state gets to come back up and do another closing argument. So let's talk about the success rate of the insanity defense. Is it usually successful, usually not successful? What's it, what's the past show about the insanity defense?
Well, you hear a lot about the insanity defense. One of the most famous is Hinckley, who shot President Reagan. Yet it's only used in about 1% of the cases in this country. Of that 1%, only 26% are successful. Of the 26%, 90% are successful if the person had prior mental illness. So that's really an important key if you're looking at the statistics, is prior mental illness before the shooting.
So on cases where it's used, it's successful 26% of the time?
Yes.
Okay. And of the successful cases, 90% of those defendants had mental illness in their past?
Correct. They were diagnosed previous to the activity.
So most of the time when you hear some of these cases or in movies, it's this person was totally normal, yet they have an insanity defense and they're successful. That really only happens 10% of 26% of the time.
Correct.
Okay, so that's unusual. So usually it's unsuccessful if somebody doesn't have a history of mental illness. Would you agree with that?
Oh, that's right. Well, that's what the statistics show.
Okay, so now that we have figured out that it's not a great shot and it's more... it's less successful than some other defenses. Why don't we talk about some real life cases? What are some of the cases where we've had these insanity defenses? Either they've been successful or unsuccessful. What is it that's happened to these defendants? What do they explain? What do they think happened? And how have you been successful in the past in insanity defenses?
A notable case that comes to mind is a case where one of our clients had come from out of state to take care of his dying father. The dad had refused medical care and was literally dying. Over the course of about 4 days, our client, not sleeping, not eating well, winds up super caffeinating himself. And in the course of his stay with his dad, winds up taking a pillow and snuffing his father to death. After that set of facts occurs, he winds up calling law enforcement, concerned for the health and well-being of the family dog. Law enforcement shows up. They realize there's a dead person in the house, wind up arresting our client. In the course of that defense, I actually went and met with the client at the jail, and he was gone. He had no idea what was going on. He thought I was the veterinarian that was trying to kill his dog. It was really odd. And at one point, I didn't know if there was much we were able to do. But at the end of the day, we wind up hiring a psychologist. That psychologist does an evaluation and says, guys, this is textbook. This guy is absolutely insane at the time. He is back to competence at this point, so we can stand trial. And I think you've got a textbook case here. We wind up submitting that notice to the state attorney's office. The state hires their own doctors. In fact, they hired two. Both of those doctors came back agreeing with our physician that this person was, in fact, insane at the time of the commission of the act. That's probably one of the ones that stands out most.
And so just going with that one before we get to other examples, what happens then to a defendant that is successful in an insanity defense? Do they just get to go home?
No, they don't go home. What winds up happening is the statute's very clear. You're going to go to the state mental hospital. And the reason is, in our case, he was still manifestly dangerous. And that's a legal term that basically means we're not sure what he's going to do if we just let him go home. So he winds up going to the state hospital for about 6 months. He has to be reevaluated by statute after 6 months. The court lessened his restriction, brought him into a local mental health facility. He spent another year at that facility. After the year, he went back in front of the judge for consideration. Ultimately, this particular defendant winds up going home. And the physician that was the state's expert agreed that this was an isolated incident, agrees that at this point he's back to normal. But let's not kid ourselves. This individual has to undergo a significant amount of mental health treatment and counseling. He has a psychologist who is appointed by the court and is obligated to report to the court anything bad that happens. The point being is he's at home and he's living as normal of a life as possible, but he's still under a tremendous amount of restriction. And it's been over 5 years at this point.
That's what I was going
to
ask. Yeah.
So when we talk about, let's say you go to trial and you have an insanity defense and you win that trial and they come back with a verdict of what? It's not just a regular not guilty verdict, right?
No, it's not guilty by reason of insanity.
And then what happens to that client? Does that person get to go home since they went all the way through trial, or are there also restrictions on those clients?
No, it's pretty much the same set of facts. There's still that set restriction if the court makes a determination that they're manifestly dangerous, meaning that they're still a risk to themselves.
Is there ever a case where the court does not come back with that they're manifestly dangerous?
You know, I think there can be, and it depends on the crime. I'm guessing if there's a...
Right.
Guilty by reason of insanity, but it's not a violent crime, there's a chance that he could be not manifestly dangerous.
I have not, in 40 years of practice, I've never seen a court just release somebody for not guilty by reason of insanity.
If it was a dangerous crime.
Right. It's hypothetically possible, but I've never seen it happen. And the reason is also why it's so rare to be successful in insanity, in that you've got a jury that's sitting up there looking at this person who maybe has committed a murder. And they're saying to themselves, you know, do I want this person to be back on the streets? I think a lot of jurors think if you find them not guilty by reason of insanity, they just walk out the door and maybe they could kill somebody else. I'm worried about my community. So even though I may think he's insane, I don't want to let this guy go because he scares me.
Right. Okay, so what other examples do you have of clients with insanity pleas that, you know, stories they tell you what happened of why they were insane at the time of the crime?
Well, we've had situations where clients have heard voices, where clients said, look, I was compelled to shoot somebody. I didn't know what I was doing. I was forced to do it by my mind. We've had clients say, the undercover agents took over my mind, and therefore I wasn't able to think for myself, and they're the ones that made the decision. We've had the whole gamut, and some are successful, some aren't. And a lot of it depends, again, on the type of crime and the type of jury and what the jury thinks is going to happen. Like I said, I think a lot of people think that the person just gets let back out into the community.
All right. So that's our explanation of the insanity defense. But there's somebody that's got a more important opinion on how this stuff works and what to look for in an insanity defense. And that is our special guest that we have coming up. And we have the privilege now of being joined by one of the experts in the area in this field, of the insanity defense field. It is a forensic psychologist named Dr. Valerie McLean. Dr. McLean, thank you so much for being with us today. And we want to just kind of kick off your portion by talking about when you're examining someone to determine whether they qualify for the insanity defense, what is it exactly that you're looking for?
Well, I think the most important thing when you ask as an expert, specifically a psychological or mental health expert, to address the insanity defense, obviously it's important to know from the standpoint of the law what they're looking for, which is that there is an existing mental health disorder that would impact the defendant's ability to appreciate the wrongfulness of their actions and or anticipate the potential legal consequences. So first and foremost, getting historical information regarding their mental health history would be one of the main things that the expert would want to gather, and then to educate the lawyers involved about how a particular mental health diagnosis may impact the person's ability to form intent or to control their behaviors. Just as an example, an untreated mental disorder such as schizophrenia, person may be hearing voices and seeing things that aren't there, such that if they're not medicated, they could have been hearing voices telling them to harm someone, or that the person they thought was a loved one is not in fact that person, and against them. So looking at their mental health history, whether they've been treated for it or not treated, whether or not they're compliant with their meds, that they've been provided by a psychiatrist, but also then taking a look at the actual crime scene itself, taking a look at the time period leading up to, during, and after the offense, so that you can look at, okay, was this behavior organized? Was it out of character? Had they had a past history of being uncontrolled for their mental health disorder and having difficulties with their behaviors? So definitely the mental health history, getting records, getting the records from the crime itself and looking at details, even from some of the officers who may note the person was incoherent or the person appeared to be responding to hearing voices. Those kinds of details are going to be very important. From the standpoint of a workup, like a psychological workup, there's testing that can be used to address mental health issues, such as, for instance, post-traumatic stress disorder, which can lead to insanity defenses or be used in insanity defense. You can assess with different tools, such as the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Test, the Personality Assessment Inventory, but also like the Trauma Symptom Inventory for post-traumatic stress disorder. So looking at test results can also help. And one of the things that comes up frequently is they talk about a person faking or malingering, and there are psychological tests that can assess that so as to determine if the person is in fact presenting honestly and truthfully to you as the examiner, but also about their details about the case. So those are just some of the factors. I think looking at the history is very important, looking at whether or not the person was on or off their medication, if they've had prior difficulties with behavioral control related to their mental disorder, taking a look at the crime scene details, the time period leading up to, during, and after. Those are some of the primary issues that I think are important.
You know, if someone hasn't experienced this type of examination before, what can they expect if they go in to see you, to talk to you? What is it that you start off with? What questions do you ask? I know a lot of this you were talking about just now are things you gather outside of the interview.
Documents. Yes, that's correct.
But in that interview, what is it you're looking for? What kind of questions do you ask in the interview?
Well, the approach that I take is to already have gathered the background information, so as much as possible to have that information at hand. Then what I look at is to do a detailed psychosocial history into their mental health history, criminal history, psychosocial background, like family structure, if there's any familial history of mental health disorders, their academic, occupational background, and also substance abuse, which can be a major factor in some of these cases, as far as if they have been using or not using drugs or alcohol. I introduce myself, tell them essentially that, you know, what the evaluation is for. It's explain the parameters of confidentiality, meaning that, you know, this is going to go to your attorney and maybe used on behalf of your defense to make sure that they're fully on the page with that. So I tend to, you know, approach it that way, to go get a detailed psychosocial history, and then I do what I call a mental status exam. For instance, if they're currently experiencing psychotic symptoms and are having difficulty with comprehending my questions, or seem like they're in like a very pressured state of mind, to determine their current mental state.
How long does this exam usually take?
The interview itself is usually an hour or 2 hours. It can be over several occasions, depending upon how much you can accomplish on one occasion. But typically I'm looking for information from them that may confirm collateral information and be consistent with what would be called some of the mental health factors that would be important and relevant in their case.
Hey, Doc, let me ask you, in relation to the diagnostic and statistical manual, what do you do for the different accesses in order to form your report on an insanity case?
Well, there's no longer in the diagnostic and statistical manual version 5, there's no longer multiple axes. It's all just one. And so what you're typically looking at is clinical disorders or syndromes such as depression, bipolar disorder, like mood disorders. And then there's also, of course, what we call disturbances in the person's being in touch with reality, such as psychotic disorders, for instance, schizophrenia or delusional disorder. So in terms of forming diagnostic opinions, you're taking the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual 5 and looking at symptoms that would be consistent with a specific diagnosis, reflected not only in the interview, but also based upon historical information.
Dr. McLean, can you talk a little bit about what the opinion is that you give? No matter what side of the fence that you're on, what is the actual opinion that you give in an insanity case?
Can you repeat that question?
Sure. What is the opinion that you actually give in an insanity case, no matter which side of the fence you're on? I don't mean whether or not you determine whether or not they're insane, but what is the actual opinion that you give? Do you give a mental disorder that they have? Do you give how it affected their actions? What is it exactly that you testify to in insanity defense cases?
Well, in insanity defense for testimony, first off, I would consult with defense attorneys to let them know what my finding was, if in fact I thought that the person met the criteria for a not guilty by insanity, and that would be based upon the diagnosis of a mental disorder that would have impacted their ability to appreciate the wrongfulness of their actions and or the consequences. So that's the first step, is to confer with the attorneys. And then typically depositions occur by the state attorney or the prosecutor, and then there's preparation for trials. In fact, it's not resolved, so that you would go and plan to testify as to the mental disorder and then how it impacted their behavior and their thought process at the time of the offense.
Usually, aren't there more than one mental health expert that examines the person in insanity defense?
Yes, and my experience is when defense lists the insanity defense as what they're going to rely on, they will list their experts that they're going to use, and the state has an opportunity to use their own expert and depose the defense's experts, so as to try to get an idea of what the defense expert would be testifying to.
Let me ask you, in your profession, two people examine the same person. One says they're insane, one says they're not insane. How does that happen?
Well, it really depends upon the way that the person understands the situation and their basically their experience in working with people who are mentally ill. But typically, people can decide that they're not insane. For instance, if a person has some substance abuse history and they may have been drinking before the offense and untreated for their mental disorder, the other expert may say, well, I think it's more due to the alcohol or the drug use as opposed to the mental disorder. So that can be an example of how that happens. It also can be based upon different testing that's done and discrepancies in testing.
Dr. McLean, do you actually treat patients as well as do forensic work?
I do not treat patients. I have treated patients previously in the past, but I currently just do forensic work.
And what is the difference between a treating psychologist and a forensic psychologist?
Well, a treating psychologist would be working with the patient to develop a treatment plan with specific behavioral goals, such as to decrease their depressed mood or to increase their, ability to go out in a social setting and interact with others. So they have a specific treatment planned, and it can involve medication as well, prescribed by a psychiatrist, and they work towards decreasing certain mental health symptoms, and typically it's done over a period of time.
Dr. McLean, can you tell us, temporary insanity versus totally insane? What's the difference? How do you distinguish between someone that was just temporarily insane at the time of the commission of the crime and is sane now, or someone that just continues to be seriously mentally ill through his entire life?
Well, I think that there are cases that are unique cases where it's out of character. The person may not have a mental health history. And, for instance, something happens. It could be a bad reaction to a medication. It could be sleep deprivation coupled with depression that was caused by, say, the loss of a loved one. And it causes them to react and to even maybe experience a psychotic break due to, like, loss issues, extensive grief. But there can be situations where it's a temporary insanity where they have no history of mental health issues, but something occurs that causes them to have a brief psychotic episode.
Okay, and why is that important in an insanity defense case?
Well, I think it's important because then you can demonstrate historically the person has had a relatively stable background, for instance, been a good provider, and that this is an unusual thing that happened for them, and now they are demonstrating completely normal behavior as opposed to the behavior at the time of the event.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Dr. McLean, for coming on and answering some of our questions, and we really appreciate your time.
Oh, it was a sincere pleasure. Thank you very much. Bye.
Listen again on RadioSt.Pete.com for another edition of the Peter's Proffer Podcast from Peter Tragos, Clearwater attorney. Find out more at TragosLaw.com.